This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Nick DiBarno here in the studio with me. It's great to have your company this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. Nick, we have a massive program to get through. I know there's a lot of hot topics that you really want to talk about. We'll save all the Champions League for later on in the program, but do stay tuned. But before we get into some of the latest news, I'd like to just say that FNR are actually really proud to announce its partnership with the International Football Coaching Conference Australia. The conference will be held at RACV Royal Pines Resort on the Gold Coast on the 25th and 6th of May. And Nick, look, if you're really interested in going, you can get your delegate pass by visiting the website www.ifcca.com.au. And in a statement earlier from our Chief Executive Officer, Dave Bozanowski, he said FNR is really excited to be in partnership with the IFCCA conference that is working with football industry leaders to deliver cutting-edge insight, research and approaches to the wider football community. We also know that there are a number of high-profile guests going to it. Former England manager Hope Powell will be in attendance, as will Socceroos head coach Graham Arnold and also renowned football analyst here in Australia, Craig Foster.
Sounds quite exciting, to say the least. Hopefully maybe we could, FNR, maybe make a trip up to Queensland and maybe do a little bit of a broadcast up there. Wouldn't be not a bad idea, to say the least. But it is a big show, Louise. A lot of special guests that will be joining us throughout the program. We've got a football historian, Ian Sisson, coming on the show very soon to talk about the soccer ashes. We're getting close to Anzac Day right now, and it's something that's started to make a bit of news a little bit. There's a piece in the Sydney Morning Herald by Vince Rigari and Don Bossi regarding it. And here at FNR, we've been covering it first. You know, we had the If You Know Your History show, which started at the end of last year, and we'll hear a bit more about that. We're also joined by David Gallop, who will be joining us to discuss how the FFA are going to be helping out and helping to find what is a very important historical artefact.
Very excited for that, and we will get to Ian in just a moment. But before we do, just some news headlines. Nick, it's come to our attention that it has been widely speculated that Melbourne City's head coach Warren Joyce would perhaps be moving on following the conclusion of the A-League season.
Yes.
But you're here to tell me that that's not the case.
Well, no, I'm actually here to tell you that's changed again. That apparently, that even though there was reports in the World Game, he get a one-year extension. I've heard that now it's not even confirmed, that apparently the talks are being held off until the end of the season, and then they're going to make the decision whether he gets the extension or not. I think that it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks. Obviously, they're going to play finals now. It's locked in. Whether they get a home final is a whole other question to get. Still got two games. And after that, depends how far they go in the finals. I think that even though many are saying that it's done, he's going to be there for another season. I think there's a lot more to come from there. I don't think it is in concrete as what we think.
Okay, so despite the World Games exclusive, though?
Well, what we've heard from a reliable source on the Twitter sphere, what I always have my cast my eye over it, is that there are reports that it is not 100% that Warren Joyce is going to be the manager of Melbourne City next year.
Well, there you go. So we'll have to wait and see yet again as to where Warren Joyce ends up and where his future ultimately goes, because still a bit of uncertainty, as you've touched on.
Yeah, exactly right. And look, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few games. Obviously, they've got some important games just to iron out and get that home final, which they'd be hoping for. Worst case scenario for them in terms of playing an away final, probably it'd almost be almost the best case scenario, be playing the Melbourne Victory potentially, which in a way, it's an away final, but is it really?
No.
It's still in Melbourne. It still makes that interesting sort of spectacle. And Melbourne City haven't lost against Melbourne Victory this year. And look, it's going to, as I said, two very important weeks now to end the season. They were quite competitive on Saturday against Adelaide United, showed their defensive resilience, but just lacked that bit of cutting edge up front. So it'll be interesting to see how they go in their next two games.
Yeah, you're right. They did lack that cutting edge. And I think even Melbourne Victory, to an extent, you could say the same thing. It was a bit of an odd round.
It was one of the more low-scoring rounds and some results which really surprised, like starting on Friday, you know, with Wellington's loss against Brisbane. And then it just seemed to never really get out of first gear. Like, a lot of the results were just your 1-1s, your 1-0s, your 0-0s. And I think, well, you know, the biggest result was a 2-1 win to the Melbourne Victory. Many thought it would be an absolute smashing, and Victory left it so late to beat the Mariners that it's unbelievable to think that was been, in my opinion, some very exciting rounds. It was just completely sort of just fell flat in terms of an attacking spectacle. But there still were some very important results which came of it.
And more importantly, we look to the weekend, and also there is a Thursday night clash, yep, which means there's action tomorrow. Sydney FC are hosting the newly crowned premiers, Perth Glory.
Yes, they are. And Jop van der Linden, Mitch Austin, two of the players have been promoted for Sydney FC, while Perth have made a whole range of changes. Jason Davidson, Dino Djulbic, Andy Kerr and Wande are all out. A certain someone said that, well, they're not going to be resting players, but they are. And they've brought in Alex Grant, Chris Harold, Brandon Wilson, Tomislav Masella, Jacob Italiano and Christian Popovic, who are all in the squad.
You'd expect Tony Popovic to rotate the squad. But then again, I was also questioning what would happen. Would he keep business as usual? We will go into more discussion on that later on in the program, because we will also be joined by The Guardian's Jonathan Howcroft at 5:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. Nick, we are now joined in the studio by football historian Ian Sison. Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Not a problem. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you in the studio with us, because we have a lot of important things to discuss. And you can see over here to our left, we actually have one of the posters up about, yes, the football ashes.
Yeah, well, the soccer, I call it the soccer ashes because that's what it was always called, you know, when it was known about. And it's a really important trophy that seems to have gone missing a long time ago. And there seems to be, all of a sudden, in the mid-50s, a lack of interest in this trophy, which was a very important trophy because it's an artefact that actually, part of the artefact actually was at Gallipoli, on the person of one of the soccer players who joined the Australian Armed Forces. And so it's kind of curious that it would just disappear from consciousness. And it's really interesting to speculate on why people would lose interest on such an ornate and quite beautiful object in the mid-1950s. And I've got my own ideas, but they're kind of theories and hypotheses at the moment.
So, yeah, well, tell us, for those that don't know, obviously, tell us a little bit about, obviously, what they were playing for. So it was, I believe, Australia versus New Zealand. They were playing in a tournament every year or every
It wasn't so much every year. In 1922, the first time, we played for the first time, and then against New Zealand. And then the year later, we went again, and somebody came up with the idea of a perpetual trophy for the winner of the series. And there was a razor case inside this cask that was on the person of Bill Fisher, who was at that time the secretary of the Queensland Football Association. And he donated it, and they put in the ashes of some cigars that the captains had smoked at the celebratory event after New Zealand had won the series. Now, that sounds like kind of daggy today, doesn't it? Like, you know, putting cigar ash in it. But we have to realise that in the 20s, cigar or smoke nights were really important moments of celebration, and so they were kind of culturally significant. And if you look at the history of any sport in Melbourne, for example, they talk in their history about smoke nights, which were, you know, it's like... You know, we wouldn't do it today, but it certainly was important then. So these ashes made their way into this razor case, which was then sealed up and bolted to the bottom of the casket, which was made of wood from both New Zealand and Australia, and quite a beautiful ornate object. So, you know, it's a real trophy. It's actually got cultural and military significance as well.
And so how is the journey going to finding the ashes? Where do we have any idea as to where we think they might be?
Well, they were last seen in Sydney in 1954, when they were the final time they were given to either team. Now, I've spoken to Bill Henderson, who was the keeper in that game. He's 89 and bright as a button, unbelievable. And he actually doesn't know much about the ashes, and that's what's really interesting, that some of the players. I spoke to Ted Smith, who played for Australia in 56. He'd never heard of the Ashes, but he quickly, you know, educated himself about it. And so I've got players like Bill, you know, on the lookout. They're trying to trace what they can. But as you'd imagine, there aren't too many surviving players from that team. You know, Bill's 89. And so there are other leads that I'm following. I'm going to go to Sydney to talk with Bill and other people. But there's a journalist that who's given me some information about possible leads, but he can't remember the name of the person who got the information. So it's going to be a long, slow slog. But, I mean, I'm happy about doing this because even if we don't find the Ashes, we'll tell a great story.
Oh, for sure.
And that's what's important to me. But if we find the Ashes, then all well and good. I mean, what do we do with it when we find them?
Yeah.
Is another question. Where do we put them? Where do we store them? Do we start up a new series with New Zealand, maybe at an under-23 game? Or you know, I don't know. What do we do? But, you know, let's hope we have that problem.
What would you like to see happen? Because that would be amazing to restart a tournament where our either men's or women's and women's national teams both play New Zealand's respective men's and women's national teams and compete for the Ashes.
Yeah. I mean, in the modern world, it's very hard for professional players to play to focus too much on national teams. It's we know there's always a struggle between club and country, and so it's going to be a bit hard to ask for a series to be played, but maybe a one-off game once a year. I mean, why not an Anzac Day game, you know, when the A-League's finished? Maybe it could be domestic players could be selected, so domestic Australian players rather than players in Europe, because, you know, this time of year, Anzac Day is not going to be a time when clubs are going to want to let their players go. So just domestic players if the A-League season's finished. That might work really quite well.
And how significant do you think in its entirety would it be? You speak about the story of it. Do you think that just in terms of actually having it, how significant will it be just to the history of football here in Australia?
Well, it's only one lost trophy. I mean, we have dozens, scores of lost trophies. As a game, we are hopeless at remembering where we put things. Okay, but I'm not sure that's just absent-mindedness or amnesia. I think sometimes it's quite deliberate. And there's an extent to which wave after wave after wave of management, administration in this game ignore what's gone before. We saw that, I think, with the Lowy Revolution. We saw that clear rejection of history and desire, you know, with the new football story. But he's not alone, or that revolution was not alone. The waves before that were responsible for forgetting what came before. And it's a really interesting mechanism in Australian soccer, and I can't quite understand it. We're ashamed of our past, and I think that goes back a very long way.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Nick DiBano, and we have our special guest and football historian Ian Syson joining us in the studio. But joining us on the line now is the Chief Executive of Football Federation Australia, David Gallop. David, thank you so much for coming on Evenings on FNR.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
It's our pleasure. We're just discussing the football Ashes, or the soccer Ashes, as Ian is calling them. David, how committed are Football Federation Australia to Australia's football history?
Yeah, I caught the end of what Ian said, and I've got to say I agree that the game does a poor job of celebrating its history. It's something that I've said a number of times, and something that we would love to see improved. I think there have been some improvements, but the fact that the game's history, much of it is in a storage unit in Botany in Sydney, is a poor thing for the sport.
The Ashes aren't so in that box, are they, David?
No, we haven't looked for them, Ian. But, yeah, in terms of this specific issue, we are fascinated by it. I certainly didn't know about the so-called football Ashes. I mean, missing now since the 1950s. And we sort of join Ian and others in making a call out to, I guess, firstly, the football family, but then beyond that, to see if we can find this trophy.
David, it's Nick here. And can you tell us a little bit about what the FFA are doing in particular to help find these ashes?
I think we can start with a broad appeal to the football family, maybe through our digital channels, and see whether that sheds any light on maybe the last time somebody saw the ashes, or maybe even to the extent that the people that were involved at the time can recall what might have happened. That would be a good start, I think, but open to ideas, and I'm sure Ian's got a few.
Yeah, well, I've been talking, David, I've been talking with a few of the players, and they're a little bit vague, but they are pointing me in interesting directions, and so I'm pretty sure that a trip to Sydney and maybe elsewhere might well be quite rewarding for me, and if I can use my detective skills that I've developed over the years as a researcher and apply to this task, I may well be able to find them if they still exist.
And to the extent that you need some assistance getting to Sydney, and once you're here, Ian, we'd be happy to help.
That's terrific to hear. Thanks, David.
Yeah, that is very terrific to hear, David, and I'm sure that Ian really appreciates your support. You touched on the fact that we aren't doing a very good job at keeping track of our history. How far off do you think we are to creating our own football museum?
I think it's a great aspiration. I think you've got to be careful when these things are established to expect that they'll easily pay for themselves. I think there's experience not only overseas but even in Australian sport where you need to be careful when trying to establish these kind of things that you don't set unrealistic targets around visitation, etc. If you do it in the right place, particularly I think somewhere where there's always football traffic, if you like. If you can do it somewhere where football people are often coming, then of course people will visit it a first time, but it's really to make it a viable commercial venture. You need to be looking at somewhere where people will make repeat visits. And of course, a really good place to do this kind of thing is in a headquarters for the game. So a home of football. We've seen that obviously in other sports and in football globally as well.
I've been speaking with colleagues about this idea, and I think we're coming to the conclusion that what we need is a digital museum. And what we need is to trace and track all of the important trophies, records, and so forth, and maybe leave them where they are, but actually cover them digitally. So, like, if we can find out where every NSL trophy is, for example, then rather than collect them in a museum, collect them on a website and say and point people who go to the website at the various trophies. And I think that's going to be much more successful than trying to gather material in one location, which would be really hard to access for lots of people as well. But the thing is about soccer is that we have so many trophies. We have so many stories. We have so many people, so many archives. It's going to be so difficult. We're a much bigger game. We're a much more geographically spread game than all of the other football codes, and that's something that's going to make it really hard to have it one centralised, unified museum.
Yeah, another idea is you can establish these sorts of things in a mobile sense.
Yep.
So do a tour of some of the key memorabilia, key trophies, etc., and then look to house them somewhere like that. I've seen that work. Obviously, in rugby league, when I was involved in that sport, we had a touring semi-trailer effectively taking things around during the centenary of the game.
And Ian, just before we let David go, you touched on the fact that Anzac Day is fast approaching. Can you remind us of the link of the Football Ashes with Gallipoli?
Well, the Football Ashes, part of the trophy was actually at Gallipoli on the person of Bill Fisher, who was a player and who was wounded and sent back to discharged back to Australia. He was so badly wounded he had typhoid, and but he got involved in the Return Services Sports League, and he joined the Return Services soccer team, and he became the secretary of the Queensland Football Association in 1923. So he was, you know, he fought and was wounded. He was actually wounded early in May, like the 2nd of May. So you can see that's not very long after he landed. He was at the landing and on the 25th, and he was injured a week later. So there's a direct connection between the trophy and Anzac.
And it is so important to remember that we need to try and keep hold of mm-hmm. this history. Yeah. And as you touch on, I don't think many people actually realise how many trophies we do have.
Yeah. Well, look, I one thing that I really want to emphasise is that we are the most popular game in Australia, the most populous game in Australia, and it stories and facts about our game remain hidden. And I put a few examples before, like, were we playing soccer in Lismore in 1927? And if we were, who won? And how do we find out? Now, just as a little experiment, I typed into Google just before I came on air, who won the 1936 Melbourne Soccer Championship? And the answer was, the first thing on Google was a Wikipedia page which gave us the VFL Grand Final. Okay? So, and you had to go all the way down the page before you could find anything about soccer. And it was nothing to do with the question that I'd asked. Where do we find this information? Mark Borich is a fantastic local historian. He believes that what we should do is have all of the yearbooks online, and he believes the FFA should mandate that for all the federations to get the yearbooks information online as PDFs or as digital information if possible.
And David, while you're still on the line, do you think that if we don't find the Football Ashes, we could possibly recreate it?
Yeah, I guess a replica is not a bad plan B, but it would be wonderful to find the real thing. So I don't think we should necessarily give up on that task. Obviously a replica is one answer if we end up not finding the real trophy.
And how important is it to keep the tradition alive between, you know, our Australian national teams playing against our very close friends across the ditch?
Yeah, it's an important rivalry in Australian sport. I guess in some respects, when we play, we have this unique opportunity to play all over the world, both for the Socceroos and the Matildas and our junior national teams. And it's a challenge for us to meet our obligations in terms of Asian football, but also, of course, big European countries, big South American countries. People love seeing Australian football against those nations as well. So something like the Ashes adds a little spice to an Australian-New Zealand game that other rivalries don't have. Of course, we've played England a number of times. The Socceroos have played England in England, but it would also be wonderful to think that one day Australia could play England in Australia. There's lots of challenges to that, travel and cost and calendar being the main ones, but we have to remember that the great thing about our sport is that there's 211 countries that play the game, and we're really lucky to be able to be a global sport.
Well, David, we know it's a very, very busy time for yourself and your colleagues there at Football Federation Australia and the head office in Sydney, but we thank you so much for coming on Evenings on FNR and giving up so much of your time.
Hey, thanks, guys. I think it's a great issue that you've raised, and I look forward to talking to Ian more about how we can help.
Excellent.
That was the Chief Executive of Football Federation Australia joining us there, David Gallop, to get his insight on the Football Ashes and where they stand and how much they are committed to finding them.
It certainly seems that we do have a lot of support in the upper echelons of FFA. So that's really pleasing. Yeah. I mean, I just hope that that level of support for something that really is almost peripheral. It's a great thing, and if we find it, I'll be over the moon. Mm. But I really the other issue that I raised, that issue of local records that we need to have access to as a game. We need to be reminded that we were playing the game at this town, in this place, at this stage of history. Because at the moment we have places like one example, Warwick in Queensland, which is out of about 100k out of Toowoomba, or maybe a bit closer. And I discovered that in 1912 they started playing the game there. And it was amazing. And the competition just grew like wildfire. A lot of little coal mines around, so a lot of Scottish migrants were playing for these teams. And I contacted the local people, the local soccer organisation, and I said, are you aware that the game goes back to 1912? And they said, we had no idea. We thought it started in the 50s and then fell away, and then we restarted it in the 70s. But no, the game goes all the way back to 1912, and we need a place where that information is just clear. So people playing soccer in Warwick can, you know, have a website where they can go to and say, oh, wow, we're part of this tradition that goes all the way back to 1912.
We almost need like an archive.
We do. We need an archive. And one of my great fantasies is a map. One of those maps where you roll the cursor over and you roll over a town and information comes out about that town. So I'm in my own hometown, Mount Isa. They started playing there in 1927, you know. And the game was played continuously from that point. And, you know, people there at the moment, you know, probably know very little about the history of the town, the game in the town. And that story gets told across Australia. At Mildura, the game goes back to the 1890s. You know, and you know, there's at Foxtel are running a little doco on a Mildura team that lost 9 players in the war, in the First World War, where you know they're talking to the people in the Federation who know nothing about this history, and you know they should, and we all should, you know, respect for the past, but also that respect for the past will give us confidence as a game. We belong here. We have legitimacy. Because too often soccer people question their own legitimacy, I think.
Has there been any word as well, maybe from the New Zealand Football Federation? Have you reached out to them to see if they're interested in looking to...
Not yet, but a couple of Kiwi journalists have been following it. Was it Andrew Vormans, is it?
I think it's some other, yeah.
Yeah, he said, wow, this is really interesting. But I was interviewed 5 years ago by a Kiwi journalist about this very topic, and they produced an article. And that's also a problem. You know, we can tell these stories, but if we tell the story, our job's not done, because we've got to tell the story again. This is something Roy Hayes says. We've got to tell the story, then we have to tell it again, and then we have to tell it again. I mean, sometimes Roy, you know, does tell stories again and again and again, but he's allowed to. So it's not just a matter of just revealing it once, because it will be forgotten. We've got to keep that storytelling going.
And you've written a couple of books as well.
One book, and I've got another one underway, I guess. But and I've written quite a few articles and academic pieces. But I'm certainly trying to. I've recently retired from my academic job, so now I'm going to be a full-time researcher.
Well, it's great to hear, and we are always looking to get behind you and, you know, promote finding the soccer ashes. And if anyone has any clue as to where they are, get in touch with Ian.
Yeah, we'll get in contact with the station, and you know, the station knows how to get on to me. And, you know, with a bit of luck, we'll be getting the show back underway, if you know your history, and we'll be able to talk more about it there.
We are looking forward to it, Ian. And thank you so much for joining us in the studio this evening.
Not a problem.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
You're with Louise Taffer and Nick Debano. We've had a busy first half of the program with football historian Ian Sisson joining us in the studio. And we also had Football Federation Australia's Chief Executive David Gallop on the line. If you missed any of that, head to FNR's website or SoundCloud, because they'll be uploaded on there. Very interesting discussion around Australia's footballing history, Nick.
Yeah, it was a very enthralling discussion, to say the least, because obviously there's so much history in the game of football. And Ian was just talking about how so many places around Australia have been playing football for so long. Like, I think even me personally, I didn't think that football stretched that far back in Australia. I thought was mainly for me, what I thought was when I first probably started delving into it, was more started around the big European migration down here when a lot of those NSL clubs were formed, et cetera, et cetera. But it's amazing how far back it actually goes, and back into the 1800s. And hopefully, fingers crossed, that the football ashes or the soccer ashes are found, because I think that it would be really cool to see like a little series as well, or if they recreate it with maybe New Zealand or whoever it might be, and they do a bit of a tournament similar to what they do with the cricket, because I think it'd be able to give rivalries that bit of juice, a bit of flair, make it a bit interesting, make it a little bit more exciting as well. Don't have those meaningless friendlies where really they could be playing a game like this for something that could be a big part of football down here.
Well, that's it. They're playing for something. And I love the fact that the actual football ashes was made out of, well, the box was made out of wood from Australia and also New Zealand.
Yeah.
So it's really important for us to keep that tradition alive. And again, it doesn't even have to be our Socceroos playing the All Whites. It could be, you know, our
Be the Matildas that could be playing New Zealand. It doesn't have to be the men.
Our youth national teams even playing some of the youth national teams in New Zealand. So,
and A-League 11 even, like,
lots of options.
Yeah.
Lots of options. And you touched on the A-League. We are now joined by the Guardians, Jonathan Howcroft. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on Evenings on FNR.
Pleasure. Good evening. Good to speak to you both.
It's great to speak to you too. And Jonathan, something that's been throughout the headlines over the past week has been the fact that Perth Glory ended their 15-year drought and finally brought some silverware back to the West. How do you think this will bode for the club in the coming weeks? Two final matches and then into the final series itself, but they've got a week off. Do you think it's wise for Tony Popovich to potentially rest some key players, or should it be business as usual?
It's a good question. I think you'd need to see the internal data about how close to the red line some of those players are. They've got a deep squad. They've got plenty of talent to spread around if they do want to just freshen a few people up. But I think sealing the title so early in the season really comparatively is fantastic for them, because it means that they can have a proper celebration. And I think we saw the other night as full-throated a premiership celebration as we've seen, really. And I, for one, endorse that wholeheartedly. So good on them for doing that. And now they can refocus for the championship and the finals race. So I think they're in a fantastic position as they've earned the right to be in after a successful season.
Jonathan, it's Nick here, and you spoke about refocusing for the championship, but one thing that Perth Glory might not have, and even with Tony Popovich compared to the victory in Sydney, is getting it done at the pointy end of the season. Do you think that will come into play at all, or do you think that's completely out of the window, considering it's a much different team and potentially Popovich has evolved as a manager?
I don't, personally, because you look through that team and you've got Tony Pignatta as chief executive, Jacob Burns as football operations director, you've got Tony Popovich as coach. You go through the team, you've got Neil Kilkenny, Diego Castro, Andy Keogh. These are really seasoned serial winners, and they're not going to be fazed by this stage of the season. To them, this is why they play the game. They're not going to have any butterflies whatsoever. It's the icing on the cake. You know, they've put in this hard work from pre-season onwards, and they've been building towards this, and that's what makes that caliber of player and that caliber of leader get up in the morning. So yeah, I wouldn't worry about them at all. It doesn't feel, without wanting to sound disrespectful in comparison, you compare it to Newcastle Jets of last season, and there was a sense of, oh my goodness, where's this come from? We're not expecting this success. This has come maybe a season too soon. And I think we've seen this season that the gap between the best and the worst for some of that squad is quite dramatic, whereas with Perth Glory, the ceiling is very high, but the base is also very high as well. So they're never going to drop that far off. I think from the finals perspective, that the only risk really that they've got is that in in both Melbourne Victory and Sydney FC, they've got two opponents who on their day can perform at an extraordinarily high level. We saw it with Sydney FC in the Asian Champions League last week. We've seen it on a number of occasions with Melbourne Victory, particularly when that forward combination with Honda and Poivonen and Barbarousis and Troisi all click at the same time. They're a very, very dangerous proposition. But I think both Sydney and Melbourne Victory will have to really push their limits in Perth. We've seen throughout the season, they just, you know, their third or fourth gear is normally good enough.
And you spoke about the Victory, but their neighbours, Melbourne City, are once again forefront of the news today with Warren Joyce in particular, rumoured to have signed a one-year extension. It's all but done. Do you think that this is a little bit almost left field, considering almost the word this whole year has been that he's going to be off? He might be going back to Manchester or Wellington. Do you think this is just extremely surprising to you personally?
I think it's baffling for a whole host of reasons. I mean, firstly, they've not performed particularly well. There's no evidence that they're developing a particularly cohesive style, which would suggest that the coach would be in line for another contract. It doesn't seem as though they're really executing what the master plan would appear to be, which would either be being an out-and-out success story like Perth Glory have done this season, or bringing through young players as part of that model to allow the Melbourne arm of the City Football Group to service the mothership. They don't appear to be doing either. They've lost players consistently. Now, whether you could put that down as a positive for Warren Joyce for this cultural rebuild, this cultural reset, or you could say it's just, you know, further example of how unsuited he is as a coach for the task in hand. Clearly, the fans, the Melbourne City fans, don't want him. They've not been happy with the football they've seen over the past couple of seasons. It just feels a very confused reappointment, if that is the case. And you know, hints at further confusion further up the chain for Melbourne City. You know, we know that they suffer appallingly from player turnover. So what is the strategy? What is the medium long-term vision? It just seems so confused.
Certainly does. And Melbourne City take on Wellington Phoenix this weekend. How do you see that playing out, given Wellington Phoenix are also in a position where there's a bit of uncertainty? It's now been made clear that Mark Rudin won't be hanging around next season. Also, it's been widely speculated that he will be joining Western United. Those rumours and reports to be confirmed, though. But how would you feel being a Wellington Phoenix player coming so far this season already to now being told that your manager won't be around as you head into one of your first final series in a long time?
Yeah, I think it depends how they've handled that internally, which isn't clear yet. I think we can assume that some players have been aware of this for some time. If you read between the lines of potential future Western United signings, but I don't know. I think sometimes we need to give people a bit of slack. You look Wellington Phoenix have been in recent seasons. What Mark Rudan has done is extraordinary. So hopefully the players themselves recognise how incredible their season has been, and that there's still another job to do, and that if it is just a one year hit, then so be it. That the players themselves will recognise that their careers at different clubs can be curtailed at the whim of a change of coach or a new owner or whatever. And that's the case for someone like Rudan. He had to wait for this opportunity. He probably took the most challenging assignment in the A-League. And if it had gone wrong for him this year, as form would have suggested it would have from a Phoenix point of view, then his professional managerial career could have ended pretty much before it had begun. So I'd like to think that the spirit that they've brought through their good performances can carry them through this next step. It seems obvious that they've hit a bit of a speed hump, but hopefully now everything is out in the open, and and they can refocus for one finals campaign and maybe even spur them on. You know, that this is the last assignment for this particular collective. But I think Rudan just deserves nothing but credit for what he's achieved.
And there's an equally big game this weekend, in particular, when you look at Adelaide United and Melbourne Victory, the original derby, considering that the winner is going to put themselves in a position where one could have the week off and the other could obviously get a home final. How do you see this one playing out? Because in particular, Adelaide, they're starting to look a little bit better, but still lacking a bit of cutting edge, and the Melbourne Victory are grinding out results. Do you see that this one will be another one of the classics we've seen these two dish out in the past?
It's always difficult to predict something like that. But I, from a Victory point of view, I think it just depends what their squad fitness is like, because they've had such a punishing few weeks that we know how good they are when they're at their very, very best. But do they have the legs to see them through this final portion of the season? It's incredibly tough balancing Asian Champions League and an A-League campaign at the same time with the limited availabilities that the A-League squads have. And with Adelaide United, you know, it's a broken record, isn't it? We know their capabilities defensively and in midfield and how attractive they can look in the final third. They just can't put the ball in the back of the net. So from week to week, it just depends on whether they can, you know, whether somebody can pop up and get the goal or two that they need to actually secure the 3 points. And there's still no indication yet that they've got that proven goal scorer. So on a match-to-match basis, they're a difficult side to say confidently how they're going to perform. I think I'd back Victory over a series of matches, just simply because there's more quality in that team. But at this stage of the season with... you know, like I say, with the difficulty of knowing exactly what Victory have got left in the tank, it becomes a bit closer.
And Jonathan, elsewhere in the game, Football Federation Australia also ticked off the new league's working group report, I believe. What can you tell us about this?
Sorry, I just lost connection with you for a second. Just repeat the question.
Just the new league's working group report that Football Federation
Yes.
Australia have ticked off.
Yes. So the way this the process of the whole new league's working group operates, the decision tree, if you like, is that the new league's working group hands down the recommendations. The FFA board then has the opportunity to intervene or rubber stamp. And what they've done this week is rubber stamp the new league's working group recommendations. So there's no further interjection as far as the governing body is concerned. They're happy with how the process has gone so far. And if you compare that to the previous administration led by Stephen Lowy, who were vehemently against it and indicated that it was against their fiduciary duties to support that process, that's clearly not the case with this administration. All that remains now is for the new league's working group to figure out its final report by the 30th of June, and then for the member federations to figure out whether they're happy with what that looks like and whether they can negotiate terms of settlement within a time frame that allows this new entity to exist in time for next season. But we're really moving to the end game now. This process that started, you know, months, if not years ago now, with the whole governance reformation piece, we're at the very, very final stage where it's up to the member federations to decide the fate of the future of Australian football.
Well, Jonathan, we must thank you very much for joining us here once again on Evenings on FNR. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday and enjoy the Easter.
Thank you very much. Good to speak to you both.
It was The Guardian's Jonathan Howcroft joining us for the journos here on Evenings on FNR. And once again, always so articulate with his answers. Always great to have Jonathan on the show.
It is. And I know you're going to love what's coming next.
Sure am. And this morning in the UEFA Champions League, boy, did it throw up the surprises. Now, obviously, the one being Ajax continue to defy the odds. Now, they tick off another giant killing, and they've arguably beaten the favourites. A 2-1 win on the road against Juventus, who were ahead in the game. Cristiano Ronaldo put them ahead before Donny van der Beek and Matty de Ligt scored the goals to give Ajax an incredible victory. And mind you, the one thing that I took out of this game in particular was Ajax could have won this tie. Not 3-2 on aggregate. This could have been 5 or 6. They were fantastic. Their ball movement, their chances were absolutely unreal. And Juventus just got worked out in every aspect. I felt that not having Giorgio Chiellini in defence was a big out. You know, Rugani was caught out time and time again. The midfield looked like they were lacking someone to take control, which is very un-Juventus-like. And it goes to show they do need to sign a world-class midfielder next season. And Ajax, once again, they're firming up, in my opinion, that there's no reason why they can't win the Champions League.
I think it's going to be a Barcelona-Ajax final.
And wouldn't that make it interesting for De Jong in that game?
And also De Ligt, because De Ligt is now and has been for so many months heavily linked with Barcelona. He has said in countless interviews that that is his dream. He would absolutely love to go there, and rightfully so, because Ajax and Barcelona have cultural ties. So,
they do, yeah.
And that's why it would be fascinating to see them come up against each other in the UEFA Champions League 2018-19 final.
The thing is, I honestly thought that this Champions League, I said it from the start that I felt that Juventus were going to finally win a Champions League because they brought Cristiano Ronaldo in, and I thought there is no way that Juventus will not at least make it to the final and potentially come up against Barcelona. I know myself, Adriano Del Monte, Rick Dundre were adamant that this was it for Juventus, that this was going to be the one where they get there. But once again, and I'm eating a big piece of humble pie here and saying it, but the Italian teams have not stepped up when it gets tough late in the tournament. It happened last year. It's happened again now. And in my opinion, I just have this feeling that this was Juventus' chance, that it's going to be now very hard for them to win it next season. If they go out and get Kylian Mbappe, what they're talking about, or get that absolute world-class sign to partner Ronaldo if Dybala leaves, or they get even if they get Aaron Ramsey, and I think maybe Mbappe, yes, could get him a bit closer, but it's just, I don't know with them. They're this enigma. They're so dominant in Italy, but it comes to Europe and they're just a complete shadow when it comes to these big games.
Would I be right in saying that Juventus are completely different with and without Ronaldo in the squad?
I think that Ronaldo is obviously a game winner. We can't discount that. He's an absolute superstar. Like he's the man. He's scored the goals in this tie. He's done it wherever he's been. But it's just, once again, I think it was the supporting cast, and it also comes down to their coach, Max Allegri, who has said he's going to be there next season. Personally, I don't agree with it because I think he's done his time. He's won a Serie A every season, but he's made Champions League final. He's had teams to win a Champions League and hasn't gotten there. Personally, I think it should have been curtains.
Do you think he'll be out the door at the end of the season in the Serie A?
I think he'll be there next season because he came out today and says he believes he'll be there next season. Whether the board think different, because I know that Antonio Conte is available. There's other managers out there they might look to go for. And I think winning the Serie A every season is not going to cut it for you, because in reality, the other teams, the supporting cast in Italy, aren't there to compete with Juventus just yet. They're not ready to. Like the other, your Napoli's, Inter's, AC's, Lazio, Roma, they're in that next bracket of, you know, they're competitive in the Champions League. They'll make it to a round of 16, they'll fall off, but they'll be competitive in the Europa League. And then the difference in class is unbelievable. So I for one, did not expect this at all, because Juventus rested everyone on the weekend. I watched a bit of their game against Spal, and they were playing all the kids. You know, Moise Keane scored again.
I know, incredible, wasn't it?
It was
unfortunate they didn't win. 2-1 lost.
I know. And Moise Keane, a chance
to wrap up the Serie A title.
Exactly. Well, they're going to win it anyway.
They will.
Barring
just
the
have to wait another week.
Yes, exactly right. And Moise Keane did come on this morning and played the second half, played the full 45, but just wasn't able to be the difference maker. But we must not take anything away from Ajax, because this is probably the most exciting team I think we've seen in the Champions League for a very long time.
Oh, it is. De Ligt, 19 years old, the youngest captain in UEFA Champions League knockout history. He scored the goal that sent Ajax into the semis. There were three under-22 players that actually scored across both legs. It's just incredible to see how young this team is. And, you know, it's that old saying of if you're good enough, you're old enough. And I am so in the same belief and mindset And I really think that what Ajax are doing is just outstanding.
And Ajax were, for a very long time, in their, I wouldn't say their glory years, but post-glory years, post this year in particular, the development team of develop the young players and sell them for the profit, develop the young players, arguably the best youth system in the whole world. But now, after this, do they somewhat become almost a destination team? Because when they play in the Champions League now, they're not going to be considered a team that you get them in the group stage, say, oh, yeah, they're going to be iffy, but they're not a team to worry about. They might just get to the round of 16 and they'll go out. But now it's almost like, well, hang on a second. People want to go and play for Ajax and want to actually stay there for quite some time. I know the Eredivisie is not the best league, but if you've got a chance to potentially not just win the Champions League this season, potentially in the future, why would you want to leave?
A good question. But I think that the Ajax team that we saw this morning, the Ajax team that we'll see in the UEFA Champions League final, if they make it,
I hope so,
will be completely different to the Ajax team you'll see next season.
Well, why? Frankie de Jong's off.
Because some of their big players will leave in the summer, and that's confirmed. De Jong,
starring
midfielder. De Ligt, I'm not sure if he'll be sticking
around. Well, there's so many clubs he could go to, really.
David Neres, who scored in the first leg of this two-legged tie with Juventus, he is also potentially leaving in the summer. There are some big clubs like Manchester United whose name has been thrown around. So suddenly, a few big giants come in and take some of your key players. It's a different look. So then what would happen is they'd probably bring
have
through
some the next wave of talent.
The backups. So that's why I say that it'll be completely different.
Yeah.
But I understand what you're saying. It could be a destination club
in
the future.
Well, that's the thing. There'll be players that would want to go and maybe now play for Ajax. And talk about two of the players as well. We talk about the young guns, but Dusan Tadic and Daley Blind, who have come into this team, even Lasse Schoen, the more experienced players, you do need them. And I think they've got the right mix of, you got your really young guys. You've got your 25, 26-year-olds in Ziyech. Also, there as well, is about 25 now. And then, obviously, you've got those young guys, De Jong, Van der Beek, De Ligt, and then you've got Tadic and Blind, who are just your older bodies who are there. Even Klaas-Jan Huntelaar of the bench, who just seemed like he's been around for ages. And it seems like that this team in particular very well could go places. Don't know who they'll come up against, but we are running out of time. We've got to talk about the next game. I know you're not too happy with this result, Louise, but Manchester United were defeated by Barcelona 3-0 this morning. In my opinion, no real shock that Barcelona won this game. But the big talking point, well, two big talking points is, one, Manchester United had a chance in the first 30 seconds to take the lead.
Rashford, wasn't it beautiful?
And it reminded me of a moment a few years ago where Pato did the same thing at the Nou Camp, got in behind and scored in the first minute. And I thought, I'm like, wow, like they're out to play here. They're out to go get them. And then a certain someone by the name of Lionel Messi, he's okay. He's an all right player. Like, you know, he's no talent, but, you know, he came
just
out.
Okay.
He broke his quarterfinal drought.
I saw.
Scored a double, and then Philip Coutinho sealed it, and Barcelona are into the semi-finals now.
It's incredible because, as you say, Messi finally broke his quarterfinal goal-scoring drought, something he hadn't done in quite some time. Messi and Coutinho netted the goals as Barcelona book their place in the last four in style. Coutinho's goal was just beautiful.
He loves those. Like, he scores just some unreal goals. Like, it seems like every goal he scores is always, he's trying to outdo himself every time. But talking about,
They're the games that you would pay serious money
exactly
to watch.
Right. And just touching on, I think, where Manchester United fell off this morning, I just think that some of their bottom range players, the class gap, like Ashley Young, I know Scott McTominay was very gallant in the first leg, but I think it got worked out a bit this morning. Even your Phil Jones and your Chris Smalling partnership in defence.
You could see with Ashley Young, he, you know, turned over the ball. Messi, you know, nabbed
once
it off
again,
him,
yeah.
and it was all too easy. Messi was given way too much space with that first goal, something you really can't afford to give Messi any, if a little. So Messi's going to capitalise on that and take his shot, and that's what he did on his left foot.
Of course, and I think that also their glaring need out wide to sign some fullbacks was definitely there. Victor Lindelof playing out of position in right back as well. They really opened them up. He's a guy who's done very well in the heart of defence. Pushing him out to the right probably wasn't the best move, but I thought that they've got the right mix up top with Lingard, Martial, Rashford. Obviously, Sanchez and Lukaku came off the bench, but there wasn't much that they could really do in those moments to try get them over the line. But I think, regardless, though, considering where Manchester United were before Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took over, it's a big pass to get to the quarterfinals. I don't think many expected them to get past Barcelona. It's such a mammoth task. But in the end, I think now their all focus will just be on getting top four in the Prem. Obviously, they got a win on the weekend against West Ham, and they face, I believe, this weekend, Manchester United are coming up against Everton on the road before two really tough games against Manchester City and Chelsea at home, and they could play some spoiler in the title race. So they've still got a little bit of work to do. But tomorrow, two big games as well. Manchester City versus Tottenham at the Etihad Stadium and Porto Liverpool. Man City are behind 1-0, but Tottenham have got some big outs. Harry Kane and Dele Alli's under a bit of an injury cloud. I think that Manchester City are going to win, and they're going to win comfortably, and they play them again on the weekend in the league. That's going to be even more interesting, in my opinion.
And we hear so often that that happens. You play one team in the Cup or the UEFA Champions League, and then at the weekend you're back playing them in the domestic competition.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how that happens, like how just...
I think it's just a fluke of the scheduling.
It's such a coincidence, but it seems like
I agree with you. Manchester City, in my opinion, I'm sorry, George Danikian, it will beat Tottenham Hotspur in this one, and that'll mean that Ajax will face Man City.
Well, just interesting, though, a little bit of a subplot here is that Tottenham have actually matched up very well against Man City previously. They've always seemed to put us some really good games. I just think if Man City score early, it could very well blow out.
And if they have a fully fit squad.
Exactly right. I think the game on the weekend, in particular for Man City, is going to be massive, and Tottenham as well just looking to lock up a spot in the top four. In Portugal though, Liverpool are 2-0 ahead. They should go through, but I think if Porto can get an early goal, it might make it just that little bit nervous for Liverpool. Might just make things just that little bit uneasy, but...
You're tipping Liverpool?
I think Liverpool will win. I think that'll probably be a draw in the game. I think a 1-1, but I think Liverpool get that away goal and it's done.
And then what happens is Liverpool will play Barcelona. Barcelona will take care of Liverpool. Ajax will take care of Man City. And as predicted,
so can
Barcelona-Ajax final.
Can Ajax knock off three giants?
Yes, that's the simple answer.
That would make it... I think if they get Tottenham, definitely win. Man City, though... That's going to be tough, but it all remains to be seen. They're playing each other, I believe. They're going to be playing each other in about 2 weeks' time is when the semifinals kick off on the 30th of April on a Tuesday morning. But that Porto-Liverpool game for me is going to be interesting because I think I want to see if Mo Salah can outdo himself from the weekend. He scored that absolute belter. Got Nick Hughes over here, our producer, who is absolutely gleamed at the thought of another Mo Salah belter. He loves his Reds, but I believe we're out of time, Louise.
We are, Nick. You've taken us right to the top of the hour.
But, any excuse to talk Champions League.
Thank you so much for joining me the studio. And if you missed any of the show, head to FNR's website or FNR's SoundCloud. We'll see you again at the same time tomorrow. Bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.